It was June about 2 years ago in San Jose, and it was a very, very hot summer. And it was humid, you know, I live by the sea, so you could smell the heat in the air and it would go in your nostrils and everything. And there was mosquitoes and birds, and you could tell the animals were uncomfortable in the heat. Well, we had been away somewhere on holidays, I can't even remember, but we left our house to cousins of my in-laws. It was good for us. It meant someone was looking after our cat, who is our pride and joy. So we had just come back from holidays then. I didn't know what to expect because while we were away, we were getting text messages from these cousins saying, "Oh, le sac à puce, le sac à puce, the flea bag, your cat is full of fleas." I said to my husband, Jean-François, "It's not possible, our cat doesn't have fleas, it couldn't be true." And I presumed they were just exaggerating. Well, come into the sitting room, and this is exactly what happened. So I came home, I didn't notice anything, I had been in the kitchen and all that, and I came into the sitting room, I closed the door behind me, I just wanted a bit of peace. I sat down in my favourite chair, and it's my favourite room in the house. So I sat down, I put my feet up on the table like that, I was relaxing, and I looked around, and I looked over at one part of the floor, and I had a feeling that the floor was moving. And I thought, oh, I was maybe tired after a long flight or something. And I looked again, and there was definitely like a mirage. I still didn't think anything about it. And then I started to slap my feet. And lo and behold, I looked down, and there were little shiny black, like dots popping off my leg. I looked at the floor and I could see them popping out like popcorn, popping out from between the floorboards. So then I thought, oh, maybe it's only in the sitting room, I thought to myself. But I went up and I investigated every room, every bed, every soft furnishings we had, literally swarming, moving. And once you're alert to it, or once you know, then you get the impression that everything is moving in the house. And a sensation of like you're drowning with everything moving, and you can't tell what's real and what's not real. It was quite horrific, yeah.
It's funny how we humans see the world, isn't it? How we tend to divide it up into things that can entertain us, feed us, kill us. Or in the case of Una and her fleas, invade our personal space and cause no end of trouble. It's so easy to gang up on the humble flea and see it as something subversive, something out to get us, something disgusting to be afraid of and eliminated at all costs. But I wonder what would happen if we got to know the flea in a different way. If we somehow managed to see the world through its eyes. Imagine if you, dear listener, were to shrink down to the size of a flea, disappearing beyond the breadth of human eyesight, down into the close confines of an alien and claustrophobic landscape, where shafts of fur, as thick as bamboo, crowd and cradle your body. Just imagine the adventures, moving through the world in different habitats, and on different hosts. You might even admire the flea and its outward form, appreciating the attributes that have enriched human cultures and even fashion.
Ladies in the 1800s actually asked dressmakers to dye their dresses the color of fleas.
Perhaps you'd look favorably on its strength and athletic ability. And you might unlock the secret of why the flea is one of the world's most successful species. So let's do that, shall we? Let's take the plunge and enter the minuscule world of the mighty flea. If you dare.
So here we are, in the world of the flea. Standing on our host. A cat, maybe? And doesn't it feel warm? Claustrophobic. All those enormous shafts of fur make it hard to even move. And it might make you wonder, how does a flea do it? Well, perhaps at this point we need to speak to someone who knows what goes on in a flea-sized world.
Someone who understands fleas and knows how they function.
They are just stunning animals.
Dr. Maureen Williams is a true flea champion. She's a parasitologist at Trinity College Dublin.
So fleas are completely unique. They're part of a group called Siphonoptera. And what that basically means is they have the siphon, which is what they bite people with. And we associate fleas with kind of, you know, this negative thing. They bite us, they're itchy, they're really, you know, difficult to deal with. But they have so perfectly adapted through millions of years of interacting with humans and cats and dogs to be perfect machines.
Imagine the flea is the perfect machine. Let's go back to you now, dear listener, in your flea-sized but human-shaped body, ensconced in a fur-tufted landscape. Can you feel how hard it is to move in any meaningful way through this forest of hair stumps? With ridiculously wide hips and shoulders. You're just the wrong shape. The flea, though, has molded its body over millennia of evolution into the perfect form for moving through hair or feathers or fur.
So they're flattened sideways. Normally, when animals grow, they're flattened dorsiventrally. These are not. These are flattened sideways. And that actually makes them more aerodynamic, more able to move in around the fur.
But that's just the start of these remarkable adaptations.
So they've actually turned their wings, which are useless if you're living in fur or on people, into really powerful jumping muscles. And they can jump up to 30,000 times without stopping. 30,000 times. It's so many times you almost can't conceive of it.
So now, dear flea-sized listener, let's travel onward to our next adventure.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, ye are all about to witness something incredible! Amazing!
And we're visiting a place where the flea's strength and endurance were once employed for the entertainment of humans.
Ye are all about to see a real-life flea circus.
Flea circuses were popular between the 1830s and the mid-20th century in England and Germany. They were a combination of dizzying showmanship and sheer audacity, as demonstrated here by Ringmaster Jay Ryan of the Pignut Productions Flea Circus Extravaganza and his star performer, Samson the Great.
So what he's going to do is he's going to push that barrel all the way up that ramp. One, two, three. Again. Three. A little bit more. Let's give a big round of applause, ladies.
Now, unlike Pignut Productions here, flea circuses used to use real fleas. And they weren't run by animal trainers. The circuses were operated by highly skilled jewelers and other craftsmen.
Watchmakers, in order to show off their skills, you know, who can make the most intricate tiny thing, would make tiny little harnesses for fleas and have them perform circus tricks.
These watchmaking ringmasters call themselves professors, and their flea performers were of the species Pulex irritans, the human flea, sourced from the professor's very own armpits or bed linen. And when you see the props they made for their stars to operate, farming equipment, tiny carriages, chariots, cannons, they truly are miniature masterpieces. And the performances themselves must have been exciting. Unless you're the flea. But you are the flea, aren't you? Remember how you shrunk down to the size of a flea in order to see the world from its perspective? Well, why don't we take it one step further and actually give you the body of a flea. Flattened, athletic. Perfect. And we'll place you in a warm, moist habitat that's safe and secure. Until there's a rustle and a jolt, and you're plucked from your nook by a hand so large you can't even behold it in full. And you find yourself delivered to an alien place, a tabletop circus ring where others of your flea kindred are performing Herculean feats in a strangely beautiful yet macabre choreography. And you feel a cold metal rope being twisted around your neck and torso. And your fate, quite literally, is in the hands of the circus professor.
You have to get everything so exact. If the harness is too small, you squish the flea, and there goes your main star. If the harness is too loose, he'll spring away, and then you've just lost him. It's kind of brutal if you start to think about it. At the same time, it's, you know, very adorable. It puts you in a very, very interesting quandary.
Back in the human world, though, people have a different perspective on the flea. And that's because we spent a lot of our shared history not being entertained by fleas, but being bitten by them.
I had fleas in South America.
Writer and broadcaster Moncon McGann remembers his first encounter with fleas.
The first time you wake up and you're bitten in the middle of the night and you think it's a mosquito, and then you see these little red marks all over your body, and you know there are fleas in this place, and you're stuck in this flea-ridden hole for the next few days. You get used to it.
And until relatively recently, in industrialized countries, people were used to it. Moncon inherited an anecdote about fleas from his parents.
We have a sort of a summer house down in West Kerry. And when my mum, when she was a child, they'd go down to the house after a few months away, and the beds would be crawling with fleas. But then in the 1950s, DDT came along, and they'd spray the whole rooms with DDT. And my mum remembers going to sleep, you know, breathing in this incredibly carcinogenic, asphyxiating chemical. And that was our cure, our modern cure for the fleas.
Before we had chemicals, though, people in Ireland were creative in their methods of banishing fleas.
There was a tradition with La Fée la Bride, the 1st of February, St. Bridget's Day, where local boys were dressed up as women, they'd dress up as Bride, and they'd hold the Bridog or the Biddy, which was basically a turnip dressed up as a little child. And so the boy comes in, he's dressed as the woman, in his hands, he's cradling the little biddy in the dressed up turnip as a baby. He sits down by the fireside, and every house he'd go to would welcome him in, would give him the fireside chair, and he'd suddenly start scratching himself. And this is the 1st of February, they've all been hemmed in the winter. He starts scratching himself, and everyone knows he's got fleas, and everyone laughs. And then he suddenly catches something in his hand, and he sighs with relief, and he throws the little insect, the little mite he's caught, into the fire, and the fire crackles. So everyone thinks this is this triumphal catch of a flea, but actually he's got these tiny grains of salt hidden in his hand. Every time he pretends that he catches a flea, throws it into the fire, but it's actually a salt crystal, and there's great explosion that he's doing this. And this symbolic idea is that he's not only doing for him, he's doing for the household. So they'd pay him well with fourpence or fivepence in every house he'd went, and he'd be off 10 or 15 minutes later to the neighbour's house. But because it was this central concern of life, like there's all sorts of jokes and stories and poems. There's a folk song, "Flea, flea, you are now betrayed, you stole my tender flesh away. My oxter pet and my bosom friend, your days are nearly at an end. Your body lies on the council table, and the hammer of death hangs over your cradle. And for all the harm you've ever done, I'll execute you now on my thumb."
So, dear listener, seeing as you've shrunk to the size of a flea, and you've experienced something of what it's like to inhabit a flea-shaped body, you might be feeling bad right now for actual fleas. It's not nice to know that you're reviled or that humans are out to get you. But this you should know. You, dear flea, have jazzed up human language and culture no end. You've given the English language rich phrases like fleabag,
a scruffy or dirty person or animal,
flea market,
a street market selling secondhand goods,
or we might even be lucky enough to be as fit as a flea,
to be in rude good health.
And of course, the English language is also replete with pearls of wisdom using the humble flea as a metaphor.
He who lies down with dogs will get up with fleas.
Meaning, of course, that if you associate with disreputable people, you too will be tarnished with a reputation or faults. But is that phrase literally true? Can humans get fleas from their cats or dogs? Well, yes and no. Scientists tell us there are 2,000 species of flea. Each species usually lives on a specific host. But a hungry flea will bite anyone with some warm blood to offer. So yes, a dog flea might hop onto a human for a quick snack, but it can't survive there. That's because fleas can only reproduce on their preferred host. Here's parasitologist Dr. Maureen Williams again.
So your basic adult flea will start off on your dog or your cat or your human. The adult flea takes the host's blood. From there, 2 days later, they'll lay their eggs. And these eggs develop on the coat and fall into the environment. At which point the eggs, like many other insect species, they will pupate. So you have a small worm worm-like option that happens in between. After they've pupated, they molt to become a second stage larva. After the second stage larva, they again molt to become a third stage larva. From there, 2 weeks after hatching, they form a cocoon. And from there, your adult flea emerges and will actually then again find its host, attach there, and continue the life cycle.
Do they have ways of surviving, you know, drought or lack of dogs, lack of cats, lack of food around the place?
They're really good at surviving lack of food. That's one of the things. They have very low requirements and they're able to output a lot of energy on very little intake. So they're really good at you know, making do with very little. These complex life cycles, so having all these different larval stages, it basically allows them, if there aren't animals around, if they're having a hard time finding things. As a pupa, you're quite mobile. You're also in the sediment. And so, you know, you can get transmitted quite quickly over a long space. And this is to the flea's benefit. So once they're an adult flea, they have quite a bit of time before they need to find a host. And the chances of something furry walking past are pretty high. Especially because a lot of mammals, so a lot of things that have fur that are the target hosts, are very much pack animals. It's very easy for the fleas to spread because we're all in such close proximity.
And this is why, in the 17th and 18th centuries, when cities started to swell and become stuffed to the rafters with people, the human flea, in particular, thrived. Which brings us to our next adventure. And this time, we're in the middle of the jostling, pulsating mass of a 17th century city. And if you'll remember, dear listener, you're still the size and shape of Pulex irritans, the human flea. But in this world, you don't have to search for your next meal, because in the bustling crowds of the poor and the working classes, or even among the perfumed elite of society, in their towering wigs and pointy shoes, you can simply hop from host to host.
Fleas were known as kind of this cross-class universal problem. It was, in a way, you know, something that humanity just had to deal with everywhere.
And some people dealt with this problem by embracing it or being inspired by it.
The color is particularly beautiful. It's this purple-orange. And ladies in the 1800s found this color so alluring that they actually asked dressmakers to dye their dresses the color of fleas. It became a really popular fashion, and, you know, people were like, oh, I want a more orange flea or a more purple flea. And they came up with these beautiful, gorgeous outfits, completely based around the color of an animal that they spent their lives in contact with.
And it wasn't just fashion that you inspired, dear flea-shaved listener. Composers like Modest Mussorgsky created musical works dedicated to your good self. His work, Mephistopheles' Song of the Flea, is based on a scene from Goethe's play, Faust. It's about a king who obsesses about a pet flea, even dressing him in sumptuous clothing.
He sent for his own tailor, who came to court in haste. Now cut my flea a doublet and clothe him in good taste. A flea, a flea, a flea of taste.
And while this might seem like a unique yet exciting idea, to dress up something so tiny and repulsive in sumptuous clothing, Goethe's king wasn't the only person to have this brainwave.
In Mexico, people used to actually dress up fleas. So they'd take fleas, they'd make tiny little suits for them, and give them as gifts. So I'm showing right now a photo of two fleas. They're dressed up in traditional wedding regalia, a little groom and a little bride, and those would be given as a gift for good luck.
It's extraordinary. Like, I presume they're dead.
Yes.
But the outfits are so tiny, but so intricate and accurate that it is mind-boggling.
But if you're a flea, and of course, you are, you'll probably know that it wasn't just eccentric kings and dressmakers that were inspired by you. Some artists of the Dutch Golden Age period of the 17th century also got on board with fleas.
I have a painting here that I can show you. Gerard Terboche painted, you know, boy ridding his dog of fleas, which is just this lovely, lovely painting of a small boy lovingly digging through his dog's fur to pick out the fleas. And I think, you know, we can all relate to that so much still today, where that bond between, you know, humans and their dogs is still so strong. And you can imagine, you know, if your dog is not feeling well, you go through everything that you can to make them feel better. And, you know, back in the day, that was fleas. This was real life. And people painted what they saw.
However, what people saw wasn't always innocent.
One of the things that old painters would do when they wanted to show a bit of lady skin, a very common theme was ladies picking fleas off of themselves. So this is a way to sort of bring a little bit of risque into your painting in a morally all right fashion. So there's quite a few of these paintings of women removing fleas from themselves.
We're looking at one there, and there's a woman sitting in what looks like a rustic kitchen, and there's shelves behind her with beautiful plates. She's sitting there with lovely dress and low plunging neckline, and she's just pulling her neckline to the left and looking down at her boob and picking stuff out of it.
Pretty much, exactly. And, you know, again, it's a realistic scene. You would have seen things like this in your daily life. But it's sort of a trick of the painters to incorporate a bit of the risque into a modest painting.
But it wasn't just painters who used fleas to provide subtle sauciness. In the 1600s, the English poet John Donne used the flea as a cheeky metaphor to persuade his love interest to, well, to do what the flea does and allow a commingling of bodily fluids.
Mark but this flea, and mark in this, how little that which thou deniest me is.
If the flea bites us both, he reasons, and innocently unites our blood as one, Then where is the harm in binding our two bodies as one?
It sucked me first, and now sucks thee. And in this flea our two bloods mingled be. Thou knowest that this cannot be said, as sin, nor shame, nor loss of maidenhead.
It's fascinating. I'm feeling a bit bereft now. I'm feeling a bit left out that we don't have fleas around us.
Well, if you wanted to solve that, there's some movies about fleas. From the advent of movies, fleas were included. In 1926, there was a movie called The Flea, where a group of rowdy troublemaking boys bring some fleas to a wedding. Before you know it, everyone's covered, and, you know, at the end, they get most of the fleas away. But it's, you know, it captured people's imaginations so much that it was just included in everything they did.
I admire that ingenuity and imagination.
I mean, yeah, and when you're dealing with them every day, it's hard not to be inspired.
Where did a naughty little flea go? Won't somebody tell me? Tell me now, where did a naughty little flea go?
This is coevolution at its finest, you know. This is the crux of two species evolving in tandem. And today, you know, we've really eliminated so many of our interactions with fleas. They're seen as, you know, this horribly unhygienic, disgusting thing, which is, in a way, a fair and unfair characterization. But in a way, it's nice that we don't have to deal with the pain and the itch and all of those issues. But we have lost this, you know, this coevolutionary history, which is interesting.
But also, we can't talk about fleas and not talk about disease as well. So they do cause problems for humans and non-humans.
They do. Plague was a big issue in the middle centuries, and it's still a big issue today. Something people might not know is that plague does occur cyclically still in our world over seasons. Madagascar had one of the worst outbreaks they've ever had in 2018, and it is somewhat down to fleas. They do transmit that. They do pass it person to person, and it's unfortunate, but it's accurate. It's why we have this gut reaction of repulsion to them. It's not necessarily wrong. It's a complicated relationship.
But by the same token, what would happen if we got rid of all the fleas?
If we got rid of all the fleas, we'd miss a lot of important ecosystem links. And I think that there could be serious consequences. It's all such a delicate interwoven balance that it's hard to predict what might happen. So until we kind of have better predictive power, until we're really sure of what we're doing, we might want to wait just a minute before we get rid of them all.
Fifi the flea fell in love with a clown from a flea circus fair. She gave him her heart.
And so we come to the end of our tale of the human and the flea. And you, dear listener, who so generously donned the body of a flea to see the world through its eyes, you're now released and may return to your human form. But before we go, why don't we quickly revisit Una in France? She's the person we met at the start of this story, who told us about her flea infestation.
The sensation was disgusting. You're scratching, you've got these animals all crawling all over you. And I could see them popping out like popcorn.
You see, the flea's relationship with Una ended in the same way as it does with so many of us. Fatally, through the careful placement of pesticides. Because even though we can admire the flea as a species, or as a muse, living alongside them is undeniably unpleasant. But however badly this relationship ends, still, there is a lot to look back on, and even admire, about our relationship with one of humankind's oldest companions, the flea.
The day Fifi died, the little clown vowed he'd tend her grave every hour. He broke down and cried when he saw her grave, and on it he placed a small flower. Poor little flea, he wasted away, he'd lost his Fifi forever. So they opened her grave, put him inside. Now at last they are together.